But you know, there are some here who may have had challenges with receiving that, and there are some whom you will share this with who also have doubts, who also have challenges, you know, and they wonder about this resurrection. Did it really happen? Could that, you know, you're just making up stories. Why is this something that's so important? And so I've asked Kevin Dombrowski to share with us a little bit, so I'm going to invite Kevin to come forward and to share with us about some of the challenges to this idea of resurrection that we may encounter when sharing this chesed, this grace, this testimony of Messiah's resurrection with others. And what do others say about this? So I'm going to ask Kevin to share with us a little bit about that this evening.
Am I on? Fantastic. I think I may have bitten off more than I can chew. I have books. So I like to sit over there by myself, being quiet. And Phil's like, hey, why don't you come up and talk? That seems like a good idea. No, that's fine. There we go. So, resurrection. Our faith, the Christian faith, is a faith of resurrection, is the central pin of our belief. Without resurrection, it's empty. We have nothing. That makes it then the pin at which enemies of the faith would come and attack. Destroy the resurrection, bring doubt upon the resurrection, and everything else falls. Nothing else matters. And today, that is coming under attack like never before. We see, you know, across the Western world, a falling away from the faith for various reasons. And one of these reasons is the attack upon that core historical doctrine. They come from primarily today two sources, meet secular and Islamic. The rise of Islam in the West is well known. People are converting, people are adopting it, and it's spreading like never before. And the secular attacks come in two varieties. They come in trying to link aspects of Yeshua to either ancient paganism, or in just text-critical scholars questioning the historicity of claims in the New Testament. So I want to talk a little bit about that. I'll try to be quick. This is, you can spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on this and never be done. So I will just touch very briefly on these, and then that'll be that. So I'd like to start first with the Islamic attack, the Islamic denial. This is the critical Quran. I think every believer should have a copy. You should know and be able to address questions. And as Paul was able to speak to Greeks from sources they knew and they understand, we should be able to do the same. So the Quran, Surah 4, verse 157. And because of their saying, we killed the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of Allah, they did not kill him nor crucify him, but it seemed so to them. And indeed, those who disagree about this are in doubt about it. They have no knowledge except in pursuit of supposition. They did not kill him for certain. So the Islamic belief is that Allah allowed a man to appear like Jesus, be taken by the Jews, tried, and killed, because Allah would never allow one of his prophets to be harmed in this manner. That is the core of their denial, the Islamic denial of the crucifixion. they get this belief from an older source from the 3rd century in Gnosticism. I'll quote here from the footnote. It says, this is the most significant Quranic appropriation from Christian Gnosticism. In the Gnostic Second Treatise of Great Seth, which date from the 3rd century, Jesus says, "For my death, which they think happened to them in their error and blindness, since they nailed a man unto death, it was another, their father, who drank the gall and the vinegar, it was not I." For the Gnostics, this denial was rooted in the abhorrence of the material world and flesh, which led to their denying altogether the Christian doctrine of the incarnation. Muslims, on the other hand, deny the crucifixion because, in their view, Allah's prophet cannot suffer defeat. The more you learn about Islam, the more you realize how much it steals from Christian Gnosticism, Jewish mysticism, and the more you learn about it, the easier it becomes to defend against. So I would encourage you, learn about it. Don't be afraid of it. Once you know more, it's really quite sad that it deceives so many and has for so long. But that's that. To the secular objections. Are any of you familiar with a Christian scholar named Gary Habermas? Yes, no? Okay, a couple. He has dedicated his entire life to studying and defending the resurrection. And to that, my tablet's not working. He has developed a essentialist argument, a 6 to 12 point of historical truth that no real scholar will reject, and he concludes that if that is true, therefore the resurrection is true, is the best explanation of the facts. So I'll go through those real quick, just 6 points. First point that nobody really argues with is that Jesus died by crucifixion. Second, disciples believe they experienced a risen Jesus. And we see a change in their lives because of this experience. The conviction, their conviction of Jesus' resurrection spread the faith rapidly. Resurrection is the fundamental of the faith, and it proves their conviction to the point of the early apostles and church being willing to be martyred for that historical belief. It was proclaimed very early in church development. We read earlier from 1 Corinthians 15, probably one of the earliest creeds in the faith. Creeds are important because they are a distillation of what you believe. If someone comes up to you and asks, "What do you believe?" you give them a little paragraph, that's your creed. I've seen some Christians attack creeds, say, "I don't believe in creeds, I believe in the Bible." You believe in creeds. So the creed predates, the creed in 1 Corinthians, Paul notes that it's something that, you know, he received, and we know that his conversion came roughly 4-ish years after the death of Messiah. So around that time is when he likely received that creed. Corinthians, I believe, was written around 15 years after Messiah's death. So we have a development of a shared view of high Christology, of Messiah's God and his bodily resurrection, which addresses criticisms that come later. And then lastly, we see the conversion of James and Paul, both of whom were hostile to the faith. We know we're hostile to the faith, having a real experience and becoming lions of the faith. So they experienced something, the apostles experienced something, the early believers experienced something real and tangible that changed their hearts, changed their lives, and changed the lives of billions since. So something real happened, and we could juxtapose this against the pagan arguments that come up, generally from people who don't know better. They see something online, it sounds good, and it's easy to adopt because we want to. We're trained that there are no new ideas, and that everything cops from something else. Everything borrows and steals from something else, and they want to apply this to the Christian faith. And unfortunately, upon closer examination, it just fails. But it sounds good. It sounds convincing. And that is enough to dissuade some people. But upon closer examination, the facts just don't line up. And that even if, and there are examples of similarities between deeds other pagan gods may have done to what Yeshua did, and even what Yahweh did. The Old Testament would often apply titles to God that did belong to other deities. But it was a polemical attack saying, you think your God did that? No, Yahweh did that. He did. He won this. And it's just a simple attack. And to a pagan audience, you're going to speak in those terms. Those cultural terms that they might understand. And the Gospels themselves did it to a degree in highlighting aspects of Jesus to even the Old Testament. Matthew often paralleled Jesus to Moses. Luke would parallel Jesus to David. Mark would parallel Jesus to the prophets Elijah and Jeremiah. This parallelism is common in the ancient world. It's new and weird to us. It's common in the ancient literature. There's also a criticism of Jesus comporting to a dying and rising God motif, which scholars themselves may even kind of differ on if that's a real thing. But they'll point to, say, Jesus' life borrows from these examples of Osiris. Jesus' life borrows from these examples of Horus. But then when you take time and dig into it, it completely falls apart. Just absolutely falls apart. I'm going to talk about, just bring an example regarding Osiris specifically and how it relates specifically to just resurrection. And the idea was that Osiris was killed and resurrected. Jesus was killed and resurrected, same thing. This is from the Dying and Rising God section of the Encyclopedia of Religion by Jonathan Smith. Quote, Osiris was murdered and his body dismembered and scattered. The pieces of his body were recovered, rejoined, and this god was rejuvenated. However, he did not return to his former mode of existence, but rather journeyed into the underworld where he became the powerful lord of the dead. In no sense can Osiris be said to have risen in the sense required by the dying and rising pattern. In no sense can the dramatic myth of his death and reanimation be harmonized to the pattern of dying and rising gods. The repeated formula, rise up, you have not died, whether applied to Osiris or a citizen of Egypt, signaled a new permanent life in the realm of the dead. Jesus didn't stay in the underworld. He came back bodily. And so again, it's not taking the claims at face value, digging deeper, and the arguments completely fall apart. So the historical objections, quickly. Again, if you go back to Gary Habermas's argument, these are all points that most scholars have no problem with, will accept, but they absolutely will not accept the Christian contextualization of those points, because As I've heard, historians cannot accept miracles. There has to be another explanation, which I sympathize with. I get it. But it still, if you dig into, even if they grant those points, you say, okay, then what is your alternative? And the alternatives are all over the map. Each scholar has their own favorite argument for why such and such may have happened. Let me go into two examples real quick. Bart Ehrman, you may have heard the name. He's a fairly well-known New Testament text critic. Being a textual critic is perfectly fine. But he was a former evangelical Christian, fell away from the faith, became an atheist, became a New Testament scholar and text critic. He would grant these points. But he believes that, without evidence, that he can infer from the text we have earlier creeds that point to a less divine Messiah, and further believes that the high Christology that we hold was a myth that developed over time. This is back to now why early creeds are important, because we can push the written documents, many of them, to within the first century, and that means we can push those creeds, which attest to the divinity and the bodily resurrection of Messiah, even earlier, within a decade or so of the event. Ehrman's alternate explanations make no sense. Finally, there is another scholar, Gerd Ludman. His explanation is that this is new to me. It's a novel take I've not heard. That the apostles believed in a spiritual resurrection, but that Paul was so convincing that he convinced them that no, it was a bodily resurrection, and he made himself the authorized interpreter of the Christian confession of Jesus' death and resurrection. Again, these early creeds make that silly. But these scholars, when they grant those minimalist arguments, those minimalist points where they have to come up with something. But they just can't agree on what that something is. So we have, as believers, we should not retreat at the critique of the ahistorical nature of the resurrection, because our argument is the best explanation of the facts. And it's on them to come up with a coherent alternative to those facts. Lastly, I want to talk real quick about a modern example of a Messiah figure. Let me get this up. I'm going to quote from the ever-reliable Wikipedia. It's fantastic. And let me go here. There was a Orthodox rabbi, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Let's just start reading from the first paragraph or so of Wikipedia. Menachem Mendel Schneerson, known to adherents of the Chabad Lubavitch movement as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, or simply the Rebbe, was an Orthodox rabbi and the most recent Rebbe of the Lubavitch Hasidic dynasty. He's considered one of the most influential Jewish leaders of the 20th century. As a leader of the Chabad Lubavitch movement, he took an insular Hasidic group that almost came to an end with the Holocaust and transformed it into one of the most influential movements in religious Jewry, with an international network of over 5,000 educational and social centers. The institutions he established include kindergarten schools, drug rehabilitation centers, care homes for the disabled, and synagogues. Schneerson's published teachings fill more than 400 volumes, and he is noted for his contributions to the Jewish continuity and religious thought, as well as wide-ranging contributions to traditional Torah scholarship. He is recognized as the pioneer of Jewish outreach. During his lifetime, many of his adherents believed that he was the Messiah. His own attitude on the subject, whether he openly encouraged this, is hotly debated amongst academics. During Schneerson's lifetime, the Messianic controversy and other issues elicited fierce criticism from many quarters in the Orthodox world, especially earning him the enmity of Rabbi Elazar Shnash. So there was a segment of his followers who were convinced that he was Messiah. He died in... After a stroke, died in 1994. Just reading up on the man, I'm impressed by him. He made it a mission in his life to encourage righteousness in Jews and non-Jews, and to bring people together, and encourage them to. If you're non-Jew, follow Noahide laws. If you were a Jew, reconcile yourself with God. Fantastic. I think that's great. But as I said, he died in 1994. At this death, there were a significant number of his followers convinced he'd risen from the dead and celebrated his death in the streets. Others kept vigil at his grave, waiting for a resurrection. To this day, there are some who still believe that he's Messiah. There are those who believe that if we checked his grave, which you can go visit, we would find it empty. Others who still believe he's Messiah believe he is spiritually present. So what we have here is a recent messianic example where that it's quite different from our own, and as our faith is criticized that the resurrection is merely spiritual, and that was the belief of the early apostles and the early church, and then it later developed into a bodily. We see how that differs with the Rebbe's messiahship. And that they can only appeal to spiritual, where in the early church and in the early creeds, we see that no, the resurrection was physical. It was experienced by up to 500 people. It was experienced by the apostles. And these people, their lives were changed. They were willing to die for this. And we have every right to be completely confident to proclaim that, defend that. And I think the defense of it is more important today in the West than ever before. Thank you.